Let's play some cards.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please.
From Harrah's Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and professional broadcaster Paul Harris.
You're good, kid, but as long as I'm around, you're second best. You might as well learn to live with it.
You got to know when to hold up. Know when to fold up.
Now, from the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.
And yes, we are both in the same place, sitting at the feature table of the Harrah's St. Louis World Series of Poker Room for show number 170. Now, just for those of you who download our show via podcast, and you're thinking, well, last week was show number 168. How'd you get to 170?
Paul can count, really. He does.
Yeah. Okay. We put out a special show on Sunday in memory of Amarillo Slim,
yes.
Thomas Preston Jr., Amarillo Slim, the poker icon, the poker legend, one of the most important people in the history of the game, the Poker Hall of Famer, who we found out died just after midnight on Saturday night. We had speculated on this 3 weeks
sure.
ago when Nolan Dalla was here. And what we did was we went back and grabbed the interview that we did with Slim at the Rio 3 years ago.
Yeah, the 5 or 10 minute interview we did there.
Yeah, tell the story about that.
We bring him up. I'd met him before and talked to him a couple of times. Really didn't know how well this interview would go. I thought, well, we'll sit down. We'll record a few minutes. I'm sure he's got some stories back here or something like that, right? An hour and a half later, we're still talking to Slim.
Yeah.
This guy was amazing, the stories he had.
Yep. So we put that out as a special podcast that runs about 50 minutes. That is show number 169. You can get it via iTunes or Stitcher Radio. It's available there or on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. And our condolences to not just the members of Slim's
yes.
family, but also to his close friends like Doyle Brunson, who
yeah.
I'm sure was heartbroken about this, knew he was in hospice for quite a while. And one of the greats. If you listen to that, you'll hear him talking about what it was like to play against today's aggressive young pros, but also some non-poker stories, including the ping-pong hustle with the Coke
yeah.
bottles, the blindfold bowling hustle,
yeah.
And the story he told about the racetrack. One
yes.
of them was where he had to out-race a racehorse in a 100-yard dash. And he said to everybody, now, we all agree 100 yards is 100 yards, right? Fine. So he went out and he put a cone 50 yards down the track,
yep.
which he turned around at. You cannot get a racehorse on its own to turn around at 50 yards. And so, of course, he beat it back to the gate.
Yeah.
But he told stories like that. It's not all poker. There's a little bit of poker in there. But it's really great stories from the life of Slim.
And the one story of his that I have not heard, I really wish we could have had him tell, and I don't know the details to it. Supposedly, he went out on a golf course against a golf pro, and he used a hammer.
Yep.
Now, that one ought to be amazing.
Yep.
So I would love to see somebody swinging a hammer at a golf course.
He also is the guy who bet somebody he could drive a golf ball a mile.
He did.
And did it on a frozen lake bet.
Yep, and he won that bet.
Yes, he did.
And I would bet, knowing him, he probably had some surveyor out there to see which way was downhill. He thinks of those things. You and I don't think of those things.
Yeah. Also in that interview, he was surprisingly candid about the molestation allegations. And, you know, you can find out about those online. But I believed Slim in what he told us that day, particularly because the members of his family have since recanted
correct,
the claims
correct.
That they made against him. Actually, they had recanted them by the time we talked to him, because those allegations were from 2003.
Correct.
We talked to him in 2009, shortly after Nolan had his conversation mm-hmm. with Slim about that. And he was very candid with us about that, wasn't he?
He absolutely was. They did recant it. Some of the story, when you actually read it, didn't make sense for sure. So I'm going to give him the benefit of a doubt on it,
yep.
and I'm going to look at what he did positive for poker and the character that he was and the stories that he told, and, you know, kind of almost like a folk hero type of deal,
yeah.
what he and Doyle and Saylor and some of the other guys did back there and traveling around through the U.S. playing poker.
The original road gamblers.
They absolutely were.
Yeah. So anyway, that's episode 169, available on the Final Table part of Dennis's website, thechipleader.com, or for our subscribers via iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Now, Dennis has literally just flown in from a weekend at the Choctaw Casino down in Oklahoma, where Chad Brown had a big event down there.
He did. He had about a 10-day event down there, culminating with a main event, $2,000 buy-in. We had 257, I think, that were involved in that main event. I've got to say kudos to Kenny Lambert, who runs it down there. That was one of the best structured tournaments I've ever been in. I love the structure for the WSOP. If anything, this might have even edged above it. It was just flat out awesome. There's no doubt about it. Very well run, very well organized, almost zero snafus the whole time.
That's nice.
So it's very nice. And they're going to hold another one this summer down there. And they're going to guarantee $500,000 for first prize down there. And the buy-in is only $1,000.
Wow.
Yeah. He's trusting that, you know, if you offer it, they will come.
Yeah.
So they should be pretty amazing.
I may have to adjust my summer schedule.
That might happen.
The winner of that event, by the way, was A.P. Farhat. You may remember that name from a few weeks ago at the WSOP circuit event here in Harrah's, St. Louis. He took second in the 1K event.
Yeah.
His roommate Kyle Cartwright took first place in that event, and their other roommate Trip Kirk won the main event here. So we talk about road gamblers and road warriors. These three guys are running around the country eating everything up.
Yeah, probably so. They were down there participating in all this. But there's some great cash games out. You would love it. There's some PLO down there that you would just die for.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I played the main event. I made it to day two. I made it just about as far as you can go and still leave disappointed.
You bubbled?
I bubbled. I went out 28th when they paid 27th.
Oh.
Yes.
You know what? This is an opportunity for us to talk about bubble play. How long did the bubble last? 10 minutes, a half hour?
2.5 hours.
What?
Well, they got down to 29. And there were four tables then, eight at my table, seven, seven, and seven. And we're playing down to 27, but of course everybody, we're close together, everybody can see it. From that point on until I busted out, it took 2 hours and at least 2.5 hours. I think it was more like 2 hours and 45 minutes of play.
Wow, that's the longest bubble I've heard of.
Other than the main event at the WSOP, it's the longest I've ever played by far. When we went into it, average was 110 or something like that. I had 80,000. At my own table, at just my table, there were three people that had less chips than I did, including a couple that were down in the 30,000 range.
So you're thinking I'm cruising here.
I'm not worried too much about it, I have to admit.
Okay, but you've talked about bubble play on this show a couple of times in the years that we've been doing this, and you look at it as, well, do I cruise to the money or do I try to accumulate chips? Which did you do?
I did not try to accumulate chips. Nobody got very aggressive at the table or anything, but you've got to realize that at the time when there were 29 people left, the blinds were 1,500 and 3,000 with a $500 ante. So with eight people at the table, you're looking at 8,500 out there pre-flop. I was solid. I had a 9M factor. I'm okay.
Yep.
I don't have to worry about it. But if I get a little bit fancy, I throw out a couple of bets, to continuation, such, all of a sudden I'm down to maybe 50,000. Then I would have to start worrying and start knitting it up.
Yep.
I was going to play. I wasn't going to tighten up the whole bit, but I went totally card dead.
Oh.
Yeah, you hate that, but you just keep expecting, well, the bubble's going to break and people are going to get back to playing normal and everything. I saw a guy lay down pocket jacks pre-flop to a mid-raise when he was one of the blinds. I mean, I saw some just ridiculous. Three different times in there, the short stack got it in with the worst hand. Three different times, they won.
Oh.
There was a series of other plays back and forth. Two of the short stacks got it in, ace queen of clubs versus pocket queens, and the pocket queens had him covered. He turns an ace, cripples the other guy, who's now down to less than 7,000. You know, I mean,
and the blinds are 1,500 and 3,000.
Right. He won the next four times he played.
Oh, is this killing you because you're card dead there?
I'm just sitting there.
Oh.
It came around, and then they started doing, which I like at the circuit, they play round for round.
Yeah.
When we lost to one person, now there's seven at all four of the tables, 28 people total. You play seven hands, and then everybody stops. Then you play another seven hands, and everybody stops. Mm-hmm. At this time, I'm down into the 30s. I've been blinded down this far. That's how many hands we had played.
Wow.
Where I can't really. I'm sitting at a 3M factor. The blinds have gone up now. They're 2,000, 4,000 with the 500. So, you know, we're looking at $10,000 out there pre-flop every hand. I can't just sit back if I get you anything at all. You've got to play some.
Yeah, you got to play. You got to pretty much raise any two cards if it's folded around to you in the cutoff or on the button.
Yeah. First hand, I had an ace nine offsuit. I shoved. Everybody folded. Second set of seven hands, I had a 9-10 of hearts. I shoved. Everybody folded. Mm-hmm. Nobody went out. Nobody. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
It didn't make any difference what happened. If one of the big stacks would make a mid-raise, somebody behind him would shove. He would tank for a couple of minutes and then muck his hand. Or if it would be one of the hands where they'd get an all-in and a call, the short stack would win. He'd either have a monster hand or he would suck out.
Oh.
It just kept going on that way. And the chips were shuffling around the table some, but it just didn't seem to make any difference. Anyhow, the third set of seven on it, 2 hours and whatever it was into this thing, it wasn't a button. Three people had folded. I look down at pocket sixes. I have the tightest guy left in the tournament to my left.
Mm-hmm.
And the small blind, big blind.
Mm-hmm.
I put my 32,000 out there with my pocket sixes.
Yep.
And the tightest guy at the table beat me into the pot. I'm not feeling very good.
No. Everybody's been in that situation where you make that move, and they do that, and you go, that's not good.
That's not good.
That's not good.
I am praying he has ace-king suited.
Yeah.
Praying.
Some kind of race.
Yeah. Well, that's the only hand he'd do it with. I'm telling you, if he had ace-queen, he'd fold it there.
Wow.
Yeah. Because he had barely more chips than me. He only had like 40,000. I mean, he's not playing anything but a premium hand. Of course, he had the two aces. It held up. I'm eliminated.
Oh.
27 people were very, very happy.
I'm sure they were. Wow.
But it wasn't bad play at all.
No.
It's just the way the things happen. Mm-hmm. So it's not any kind of bad beat. It's not anything like that. You've got to make a lot of decisions when you're down there on the bubble, especially if you turn into one of the short stacks, because you can't continue to get blinded down. If you get down to lower than a 2M factor, you're going to get called,
right.
Period. I was down pushing it right there with 3Ms with only 32,000. I was afraid somebody would call me just with ace rag with, you know, basically nothing. Ace probably would call, but, you know. So I was really skirting with it myself already. You just can't get any lower than that. You've got to find a hand. You've got to gamble. If everybody folded to you and you're on the button, you don't even look at your cards. You put your chips in,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you get down that low, you know, you're dead otherwise.
Now, let's talk about bubble play at the other end of the spectrum. You're talking about when you're either a short or a close to short stack.
Yeah.
What if you're one of the big stacks at the table? Are you then three-betting people who are making moves, or do you have to be careful because they're probably going to commit their chips once they raise? You know, they don't really have two moves. They have one move, which is getting it all in. What's your range of calling and three-betting?
Well, what it is there, if I'm the dominant chip stack, obviously, if I have any kind of a hand, a decent hand, they're going to be shoving with a wide range. I'm going to be doing a lot of calling on that case. But I like to be the aggressor. I like to be the one opening up. If a short stack mid-raises comes in or something like that, I'm going to have a hand probably to get involved with it or something I can draw to mm-hmm. get in with risking very few chips. If I have somebody behind me that's on the button or the small blind or the big blind that literally is down to that 2M factor, I have to be willing to put that many chips in there with whatever hand I have.
Right.
But if it hasn't been open to me and I am anything but under the gun there with seven people, I'm probably raising 80% of the hands if I'm the dominant chip stack.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put it in there with almost anything just to see what happens, unless somebody acts ahead of me.
Because the thinking is everybody else is afraid for their tournament life there. And
they fold pocket jacks. What more could you ask for?
If you can pick up 8,000 or 10,000 chips.
Every hand? Think on that.
Yeah.
You know, a big blind is only 4,000. You can bet 9,000 up there to pick up 9,000 or 10,000 chips.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good ratio.
Yep.
And if they're scared to play and they're only playing premium hands, how many times do you have aces, kings, queens, ace, king? You don't very often.
All right.
Most of the time they're going to be folding.
But let's go back to the range. Let's say somebody else does move all in. What's your range of calling there? They're a very short stack. You're the massive chip leader at the table. But chips can hurt you. You know, you call some short stacked all-ins three or four times, and all of a sudden you look down and you're not the big chip leader anymore. You frankly have given away chips. So where's your range? Are you making that call with pocket fours?
Again, depends. There's where your table read comes into play so much. If this guy is pushing with almost any two cards because he's down to a 2M factor or something like that, I'm calling with pocket fours. If I've got, him outstacked 10 to 1 or something like that, I'm probably calling with pocket fours. And I'll take the race there to try to eliminate the person.
Mm-hmm.
If he's going to hurt me, maybe even if he only has 20% of my chips, I'm going to hesitate a little bit with that. I may want to pick a little better area because I don't need them. I can sit here and float for a long time if I want to, and I can pick up an awful lot of hands. Actually, when you're the dominant one, you don't want the bubble to bust. Because you raise, you raise, you raise, you take three pots down, you raise again, somebody comes over the top, oh, I fold that one, no big deal, and then I raise again.
Right.
You know, you take, you're building chips by doing that. All you have to do is win two out of three, and you're getting a massive amount of chips.
What's your ace range for that call? You would make it with pocket fours against some people. Mm-hmm. Would you, against that same person, would you make it with as low as ace six, ace seven, ace eight, ace nine?
I wouldn't want to, but there's a good chance I would with almost any ace. If he's shoving in there with that low of a factor and I've got an ace, my chips are probably going to call him. Again, it's that same thing. If he's only got like 10% of my chips and I look down at an ace and he's way short shoving, yeah, I'm probably calling.
Wouldn't you be afraid that they're playing any ace at that point? And if you're calling with ace deuce, ace three, ace four, even ace five, you're probably going to be behind?
May or may not be, because you also, they're going to be doing with any two face cards or any two Broadway cards or any low pair or a whole lot of different things there.
Yeah.
Could you be behind? Absolutely. But you've got to realize, if there's 10,000 in the pot and they're only shoving in 20,000, that's 30,000 total, going to cost you 20. All you have to be is a 40% to justify the call.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times you can be 40% with just an ace rag.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, no, I have no problem doing that.
All right. Well, I'm sorry you bubbled that event.
It happens. I wasn't very happy. I went over in the corner and cried for a while. But it wasn't bad play. It wasn't bad beats. It's just the way the cards worked out. So,
a lot of talk in the last week since our last show about the possibility of PokerStars buying Full Tilt Poker after we got the official statement from the Bernard Tapie Group that they were withdrawing their offer. There's a poker reporter by the name of Diamond Flush who just put out a story just about 40 minutes before he went on the air today.
I have not seen this.
And she got her hands on an email from Laurent Tapie. That's Bernard Tapie's son, who had been the chief negotiator for this whole deal. This is an email that he sent out about a week ago to the key employees of Full Tilt Poker, addressed to the key staff, as it's called. And it's addressed Dear All. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. But let me just tell you a couple of things in here that are interesting, and we can discuss them. At one point, he says, the deal with DOJ is off, and the negotiations are terminated. Ultimately, Department of Justice refused to accept GBT's proposal for repayment of the rest of world players, a proposal we thought had been accepted. And on the 14th of April, they informed my lawyer that they could only agree on an agreement where GBT would pay 100% of the $184 million the rest of the world players have in their balance, and we'd have to pay it in a maximum of 90 days. We had put out a plan in which 94.9% of rest of world players would be paid back some money on day one.
Some money or all money?
Well, it says, furthermore, we would have repaid, and then in parentheses, allowed withdrawal of funds for 94.9% of ROW players day one, 4.9% of ROW players in 18 months, and only 0.2% of those players in more than 18 months, with a maximum of 5 years for the very large balances. I'm guessing that's six-figure balances.
Yeah, I would guess so, too. But they're saying by number of players, the majority of people had very, very small deposits in there.
Which you think is what, like 100 or 200?
Again, I don't know, maybe so, something like that. I really have no clue as to the exact numbers. But it's those people with the big accounts in there that then would have to wait up to 5 years to get fully reimbursed.
Right. Well, I would think that anybody who has money in there, even if you're part of the 5% of rest of world players who has to wait 18 months, you know, it's not great news, but at least you could see it on the horizon. But I think it depends on how GBT would have allowed you to do that. This is all a moot point now since the deal is off.
Yeah.
But if they were only going to allow you to play on the site and withdraw a little bit every once in a while, then that's not a deal at all.
They're
expecting you to continue to play to create rake so that they make money, and with that money, they're going to pay people back.
Which may have been what it was. They may have put a maximum withdrawal every 30 days or something like that in there.
Right. So he says, I'm unwilling to allow 7 months of effort to go to waste, to see 200 employees lose their jobs, and to witness former Full Tilt players around the world go unpaid. This is Laurent Tapie in his email to the staff. For that reason, I have decided to devote a significant portion of the funds that I was planning to use for the acquisition of the FTP assets instead to launch my own company under the auspices of Game Cubed, the company I've created in Ireland. I will do this only if I can attract all of the Pocket Kings key staff to join me. Pocket Kings were the people who ran the software for Full Tilt Poker. He says, with your help and know-how, we will launch a new website that will be best of breed in 6 to 7 months. I know that any such step requires a leap of faith, so here's my offer. As of May 1st, I will hire the entire Pocket Kings key staff, every single one of you with your current salaries and with your accumulated benefits intact. I'll include stock options in the new company so we all share in what I believe to be the exciting upside this represents. We will write a new poker software platform based on your knowledge and relaunch using a new brand with an offer to former Full Tilt Rest of World players that will allow them to recover their lost balances if they come to our new site, just as we had planned in our agreement with DOJ. Now let's just go back to that last part there. Rest of World players would be able to recover their lost balances. How exactly is that going to work?
I have no clue at all. He's looking at a nine-figure amount. No, and it doesn't even make any sense. If he's going to allow them to recover their accounts, why didn't he just work that out with the DOJ and pay them immediately?
Within 90 days.
Yeah. That doesn't make any sense to me.
I don't know either. If you're a member of the staff there in Ireland who had worked on this, and that's where Full Tilt Poker was technically based in Ireland, and the Alderney Gaming Council oversaw them, supposedly, from Ireland. If you're a member of that Pocket Kings key staff, you're out of work now. Do you say, great, I'm coming to work for you, let's write new software?
I mean, there's not a lot of downside to them. If their benefits are going to be intact, if their salary is going to be intact, if they're going to be given stock options, even if they're out actively looking for another job, you know, why not go along with this? I could see a lot of people jumping at that.
Yep.
I don't know about all of them.
Now, today, as we record the show, is May 1st. So today was the deadline, and we don't know.
I've never seen that before or heard it, so that's brand new to me.
But remember, he says in here, all of the Pocket Kings staff to join me.
Yeah,
and we'll launch a new website that'll be best of breed in 6 or 7 months. How many people have said this is going to be the best poker software in the world, and then found out, you know what, Full Tilt and PokerStars pretty much had that cornered?
Yeah, well, you can always dream of building a better mousetrap, but a lot of times the rodent runs away.
That's very well put. PokerStars' statement after we went off the air last week about the purchase of Full Tilt. And by the way, here, as I've been playing PLO over the last week, there have been some people who had money on Full Tilt who are excited about it, thinking that PokerStars is going to be writing them a check in the next week or so. It's not going to be happening that soon, if it happens ever. All they said was, we've had a lot of inquiries, there's a lot of speculation. Settlement discussions with the Department of Justice are confidential. We're unable to comment on rumors. As soon as we have information to share, we will do so.
Yeah, and again, that's what you... What was the comment you said last year? You know, I neither confirm nor deny, and my confirmation nor denial does in no way, shape, or form
constitute a confirmation or denial.
Yeah.
Right. And I will issue the same warning to everybody that I issued on last week's show, which is there is no deal until the Department of Justice says there's a deal.
That's true.
How many times over the last 3 months did we hear people affiliated with Full Tilt or in the poker media saying, oh, it's happening, it's imminent. Tony G said on this show, oh, yeah, next 7 days.
Yep.
Full Tilt Poker will be back. They'll be making an announcement of a deal with the Department of Justice. Have we ever heard Parit Bharara say one word since Black Friday about this?
Not an official word that's going to say that the money's going to be coming back. Absolutely nothing.
As far as I know, the only thing they did after Black Friday was issue more indictments. They did not announce any new deals.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure a lot of attorney got checks.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Yeah.
I want to play you a piece of audio here while we're talking about Full Tilt Poker from Howard Lederer, who was one of the founders of it and one of the people indicted for the goings-on at Full Tilt Poker, the lack of money to play people back. This just showed up on the Internet a few days ago.
Oh, my gosh. I can just imagine.
There's a website called Big Think, which... You know, there are TED conferences online where people get up and they make these 18-minute speeches about various things, and those have become very, very popular over the last several years. Big Think looks to me like a site where they get a bunch of, quote, experts together, and they ask their opinions about various things in extended interviews. There are all sorts of business leaders on there, people from media, politics, online, all sorts of businesses are involved. And both Howard Lederer and his sister Annie Duke were interviewed on there.
People should remember, you know, is this thing on? Is this recording? Is anybody going to hear this?
We don't have time to play you the entire interviews from both of them or even a clip from both of them. But I do want to play you a couple of minutes of Howard talking about business ethics. Now, remember, this had to have been recorded before Black Friday.
Well, yeah, obviously.
Because since then, like the no comment we're getting from PokerStars, Howard hasn't said one word publicly about this. I'm sure his lawyers had told him not to. There's debate about whether that's the right thing to do. But anyway, this must have been recorded over a year ago. Listen to it in the context of what we know now, 13 months after Black Friday. Here's Howard Lederer.
One thing that we're all acutely aware of in the poker world is that we only have our good name. And, you know, you can't borrow a bunch of money and then say, sorry, I don't have any money. I'm going to declare bankruptcy. And then, like, a month later, you come back into the poker world under a different name, right? You can do that in business. So, but you can't do that in the poker world. So people always remember that you were that guy that stiffed everybody and didn't pay back. And that hurts you, not just the fact that you have to deal with these people that are constantly hounding you for money and you're being dishonorable and not paying them back, but also people won't trust you. So then you have to be extremely risk averse your whole career, because if you ever lose your bankroll, you're out. No one's going to help you get back in action. One of the best pieces of advice, or maybe, you know, one of the best observations, particularly in the poker world, that I got was from a player who once told me that honesty is the best hustle. And what he meant by that was that if you are truly honest and the poker world perceives you correctly that you're honest and that you're a trustworthy person, then you create a group of friends that all are willing to help each other. You gravitate toward other honest people, and that allows you to actually play bigger, maybe beyond your bankroll, be a little less risk averse with your bankroll, because you know that you'll have people that'll pick you up when you need some picking up. And likewise, you'll pick them up. And kind of, if you think about this group of, let's say, 10 people that all really trust each other, they can all play maybe a little bit beyond their bankroll, but they're not really playing beyond the bankroll of the group. Some of them will be up, some of them will be down, and if everyone's willing to pick each other up and they're honorable with each other, then I think in the long run the group does better that way.
Wow. Do you think he was talking about the group that came out of New York from the club up there,
from
maybe?
From Mayfair Club. Eric Seidel.
The whole bunch
Dan
of them.
Dan Harrington and the rest.
Because they played together, and some of them came together out to the World Series, and they you know, it was kind of a group of about the same age, you know, give or take a few years, of course.
Or when he says the group can play bigger than their bankroll, is he talking about the Full Tilt guys who were playing bigger than their bankroll because it was somebody else's money?
No, I hope he wasn't talking about that. I don't think he was. He actually makes some very valid points. Unfortunately, they're coming home to roost with him, but he makes some very valid points. The poker world, you can't run and hide. If you do something at the table, everybody in the poker world is probably going to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
If you stiff somebody, if you don't pay off, I mean, how many different sites or people can you name, you know, that for one reason or another they had even a prop bet, or they had a part of a person and refused to pay it, or they borrowed money here, there, and everywhere, and then they're running from people. We know who they are.
Yep.
You know, I can name a dozen now off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they'll ever have a good reputation again. Well, Howard.
I just want to repeat my favorite line from that. Honesty is the best hustle.
Ouch.
Honesty
I got it.
Just let that one sink in while we take a quick break. Then we're going to talk with Sam Barnhart, who was last year's World Series of Poker Circuit Champion winner and finished 17th in the main event of the World Series of Poker. This from a guy who was down to his last $200.
Yep.
Sam Barnhart joins us when we come back with the Final Table Poker Radio Show. We're live at Harrah's St. Louis in the World Series of Poker Room, where the Bad Beat jackpot is $86,000. Oh, and this weekend, you can start your march to the $1 million buy-in event this summer at the WSOP. They're going to be running what they call wild card weekends here for the next 3 weekends. Fridays at 1 and 7, Saturdays at noon, 3 and 6. It's a $100 buy-in. It's a shootout format. You win your table, you get your $100 back, and now you're really free rolling, because then you move up to step two, which is the $565 tournament on May 20th. You win that event, you go all expenses paid to Las Vegas to play in the WSOP One Drop Satellite event, which is a $25,000 buy-in event. You're in it, free-rolling, one seat guaranteed to that event, and one seat guaranteed out of that event into the $1 million buy-in this summer, which will be capped at 48 players, and as Dennis has pointed out, $17.4 million to the winner of that.
I've heard those shootouts aren't a bad way to go.
You and I have both gotten into the main event that way. Turned you into a poker millionaire. I'm hoping it turns me into a guy who min-cashes. I've been telling people for the last couple of weeks. People say, oh, it'd be great if you could repeat that as a success. I tell them, I want to make it the dinner break on the first day. I'm reaching for the first rung on the ladder, not the last rung on the ladder. I'm not making plans for October yet. I'm making plans for July. Same for you. You could be there at this satellite event and then play in the $1 million tournament against, yes, some of the best players in the world, but also some really rich guys for whom $1 million is chump change.
And also remember, if you've ever read Jerry Yang's book, he talks in there about the seven times in the first two levels that he got pocket aces, and he won all seven and got paid off all seven times.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter how you play, you know, if you get pocket aces seven times in the first two levels, you're probably going to be okay.
Just making a note here, good strategy, get pocket aces as often as possible.
See, there you go.
Okay.
There you go. That's all you got to do.
So once again, wild card weekends, May 4th and 5th, May 11th and 12th, May 18th and 19th, all $100 buy-ins, Fridays at 1 and 7, Saturdays at noon, 3, and 6. They'll cap it at 5 tables each time. Get as many people involved in this as possible. And then the winner of each of those tables goes on to Step 2. The winner of Step 2 goes on to the 25K Satellite. The winner of that Step 3 goes into the $1 million buy-in at the Rio this summer. Details, go to harrisstlewis.com and click on the Poker Room Tournaments button right there. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com, with our podcasts on thechipleader.com and iTunes and Stitcher Radio, too. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, live from the World Series of Poker Room of Harrah's St. Louis. You can always find out what games are going on here and how many people are on the waiting list by downloading the Bravo Poker Live app. And then just click on Harrah's St. Louis in there. Bravo Poker Live, available for both iPhones and Android phones. Find out about the PLO games, the 3-6 games, the 1-2 games, the 2-5 games, the 20-40 games, and all the tournaments that go on here as well at Harrah's St. Louis.
Our guest today is Sam Barnhart, who had an amazing 2011. He entered a super satellite that put him in the WSOP main event at Harrah's Tunica. I believe, as he was walking out the door, he got talked into it with the last couple hundred bucks he had in his pocket. I'm going to ask him about that. But anyhow, went into the Super Satellite, which he won, earning him a spot in the WSOP Circuit National Championship at Caesars Palace, which he won. And then to top it off, he made a deep run in the WSOP main event, finishing 17th. And I know how hard it is to finish 17th in that kind of a thing. That brought his tournament earnings for the year to over $800,000. Sam was just here at Harrah's St. Louis for the WSOP Circuit event, where he made a final table in the six-man event. Last year, he made a final table here in the horse event. I'm thinking Sam likes the Midwest a lot.
Yep.
Anyhow, Sam, welcome to the final table.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
So, got to ask you to start with, is this totally changed around what your life's been for the last year? I mean, are you traveling all over the place, a ton of tournaments now?
Yes, it definitely changed it. I'm traveling to circuit. I'm playing the circuit events and trying to, of course, chase the points in order to get back into the national championship.
Are you close?
Yes, I've got 92 points. So right now it's still at 95. We figure maybe 100 points by the end. So I've got to at least get probably 8 more points.
You're definitely one of the bubble. I'm at 70 points. I am way behind you. I need to run deep in some event in order for me to qualify.
So does that mean you're both going to be going down to New Orleans and trying to play a lot of events down there?
Absolutely, probably. I'll be there.
I have a feeling there's going to be an awful lot of people down in New Orleans.
That Circuit National thing has really changed things and brought a lot more people out onto the circuit, hasn't it, Sam?
Most definitely. The thing about what's great is, number one, you've got a great value for your money to get in. And number two, just like what happened to me last year, it gives a poor guy a chance to achieve great success. You just can't beat it.
Well, how do you like it this year? Because they made a little bit of a change. It's going to be the top 100 from the circuit, with the winners of the main event of the circuit, the winners overall at each of the circuit event, and the top 66 point getters. But they've also opened it up to the top 100 people for the last 2 years that have done well in the WSOP events here and in Europe. So you've got 100 potential pros also joining the field. Is that good or bad?
Well, as far as, you know, the money stands of what you can win out of it, I mean, it's going to probably double the first place. But I have reservations about it. I think that for the circuit players, and I've been on the road a lot, and if you talk to them, they work really hard for this. And for to let a pro come in and just pay the 10 cray to get in it, I feel that they did not really earn that spot. I have been offered to pay the $10,000 to get in it myself, because in order to defend it. But I have decided not to do that. If I cannot earn my way in it, I'm just not going to pay it.
Why not?
I've got a little reservations about it.
Why not, Sam?
Well, I think that this is something that for the circuit players that work really hard to earn it. It's like going through college and you have to work. I worked my way through college to having somebody to pay for it. And I think the national championship's your reward for it.
So what was that story that Dennis told, and which Nolan Dalla told about you 3 weeks ago on this show also? Is that true that you were down to your last $200 and you're walking out the door and a WSOPC employee says, hey, come play this mega, and they talked you into it?
Well, yeah, you know, it was funny. I was running real bad in Tunica. Of course, Tunica is my backyard from Arkansas. The circuit event there. I was running really bad, and I checked out of my hotel, and I actually had $300 in my pocket left because I put myself on a budget. And I was on my way home, and I actually turning left, I decided to turn to right out of the hotel and go by the poker room in the tournament area, and it was early in the morning, and Teresa Summerfield was there, Jimmy Summerfield's wife, and she had a last single table 180 tournament going on. And I just thought, well, what the heck? I have nothing to lose. I'm on my way home anyway, so I decided to play it, and voila.
Well, you had $180 to lose, but I think you kind of did well with it.
Yes. It definitely got on a run of a lifetime. You don't see those kind of runs too often. I thought the national championship was one of the toughest tournaments I've ever been into. They were 3-4 betting it all the way down with nothing. And these young guys I was dealing with. So I had to adjust my game pretty quickly in that tournament. I took a chance. I left Arkansas in May. I decided, well, once I won the Tunica event, I thought, well, I'm going to give it a shot for a year. It's about anybody really plays poker seriously, that's kind of a dream to just play poker for a year and try your shot at it. I had no idea the kind of run I was going to get involved in. So it really, really worked out, and it's been a blessing.
So, quick question. Have you sent flowers to Jimmy Summerfield's wife?
Well, we did have a bunch of us went out to eat, and we got together. They're really good friends of mine.
Excellent.
I think a lot of them. I always have. I've known them for years from the horseshoe. I went down. I was pretty much of a regular down there in the 2040 limit game they had there at the Horseshoe. So,
I can tell you, as a person who used to play 2040 limit here in St. Louis, the people here used to talk so much about the 2040 at the Horseshoe in Tunica that I took a couple of trips down there, and that was always a great game. It still goes on. It's not nearly as great as it used to be. Nowadays, they're only getting one table where they used to get two, three, four tables going. But talk a little bit about the impact of being a Tunica poker player, because it's really a culture unto itself. And how valuable was that in your learning to become a better poker player through the years?
Well, Tunica poker player, when you have an opportunity, of course, Arkansas has no poker, so you're limited on where to go, Oklahoma to, you know, Mississippi, whatever. But Tunica was a great place to kind of learn the ropes. You can go in there. You don't have to play the 2040. You can play, start out, and I did. I started out playing the 4-8. And if you want to go in the no limit, you can play the 1-3. And they also have great little, you know, weekend tournaments there. And start off small and start learning how these games go and start reading it. It's all about observation, to my opinion. It's about observation at the table. And, of course, obviously, your cash games are going to be played totally different than your tournament. And sometimes I have seen that it's difficult for some people to differentiate the two. But you've got to start somewhere. And in some of those small buy-in tournaments is excellent in that area.
I had gone down to Tunica, in fact, when I was trying to see exactly whether I could play with some of the big boys or whatever. I went down to Tunica. I played two different circuit events down there, and I ended up final tabling both of them, went to the seventh and one and eighth and another one. And I found out on the cash games that there was a couple of tables. You had to walk through the cash games to get to the tournament area, and then everybody that busted out had to walk through the cash ones. And there were two or three tables right by the door of the tournament, which always seemed full. And it's amazing how they'd say, tell us your bad beat story. Sit down here. Oh, yeah, you need to put a little money on the table, but tell us all about your bad beat story. I swear, they were like vultures waiting for the guys on tilt to come out of the room.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. You know, I have found that I have heard so many bad beat stories. Even in St. Louis there was a guy that actually it seemed like he was waiting at a door for me to come out. At the hotel, just so he could explain to me how he played his cards the previous day. But I've ran into that, and I'm sure y'all have too.
Oh, yeah.
In the past, and that happens, and that comes with it, and I try to help as much as I can. But I know that some people want answers from me that I can't give them.
Oh, absolutely. And what was it? One poker player said that you know you're a mature poker player when not only have you heard of every possible bad beat, but you've experienced it, too, because it's going to happen to you.
Absolutely.
Yes.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris. We're talking with Sam Barnhart, last year's World Series of Poker Circuit National Champion. He's trying to get back into that championship if he can get enough points in New Orleans to get himself to Caesar's Palace this summer. I want to ask you about the main event of the WSOP last summer, because we got a few people, once we promoted that you were going to be on the show today, they tweeted questions for you to Dennis underscore Phillips or to Paul Harris Show, both of those on Twitter. So one guy wanted to know about day one, and I guess this made ESPN and is on YouTube, and it kind of made you a little bit famous there. On day one, when you laid down kings pre-flop against a guy who, I don't know if it was a four-bet shove or a five-bet shove from this guy. I'm sure you remember the hand. Can you take us back through it? We know, because we saw it on TV, that he had aces and you made a great laydown there. But can you go back in your mind and walk us through that hand?
I think that was like day three or four. It was a little on. And that kind of a, you know, a lot of people will come up to me and they remember me dropping the kings down pre-flop, but they don't remember when I finished. And so it's kind of ironic that ESPN, you know, is this it happened to be caught on TV, and obviously in our in a poker's life, you don't hardly drop kings. That's the second time in my life I've dropped kings for flop. And so happened was you had a bet, and then you had a raise, and it's come back, and I re-raise. And then you got a fold, and then you got a guy that pushes all in. Well, you've got to understand, especially in this circumstances, in my tournament play, I play a player as much as I can. The cards going to play themselves, but you also have to play the player. This guy was from Brazil. I've been playing with him for a very long time. And the way it worked out, it took a long time, probably a lot longer than what the TV pictured it. But it's not easy because you're trying to convince yourself you've got the best hand, and it happens a lot. But with this particular player, that's the only thing he could have had. He was very, very conservative player. Like I said, I've been watching him. I've been playing with him a long time. If it would have been with Ben Lamb or somebody like that, I would have went broke. But it's all about observation.
I love that analysis of it because you're 100% right. So many people, when they get into the tournament, don't realize how valuable those chips are.
Right.
I guess the easiest way to say it is, you don't have to win every battle to win the war. And I will sit at
there
a table and I will watch people making three-bet bluffs and this and that and raking in chips and getting a mountain of chips by the third level. And then day two, I'm still playing and they're on the sidelines playing in a PLO game or something like that.
Yeah.
You don't have to win every hand. And if you are of a quality enough player that you can make those laydowns, even if you're wrong, I have to respect
right. That.
You know, if you can.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You know, maybe it was a 50% chance that he had ace king in your mind or the other two kings or something like that. But you knew that this is your tournament life and those valuable chips. And do I want to risk my tournament life on the chance when I really think it's most likely that he has aces? I applaud you for
right.
it. No, it's excellent. If you'd have been wrong, I'd have applauded you for it because it's an excellent
right. Analysis. Right, and it would have looked bad, but
well,
that's okay. You're absolutely right. I think I have seen it, too, so many times when players cannot fold that second best hand and go on to the next hand.
Yep.
So what if I was wrong? There's always another hand.
That's 100% right. I love that analysis of it.
Did you watch
Sorry,
go ahead.
No, I haven't, watched, I actually hadn't even seen that part of it. I've been on the road too much. I hadn't been able to watch a lot of it. But the fact is, and also I really think that poker's changing. I think the Gus Hansen approach of this wild 3-4 betting is kind of slowing down because of the fact that we know it now.
Yeah,
and we can play those good hands, and the poker community is getting a little bit more educated about it.
Yeah, I agree with you. When you mentioned Ben Lamb played great, absolutely no problem. So this is in no way, shape, or form any kind of slam against him. But you're much more likely to call Ben Lamb there than you are somebody that like the gentleman you described. You know,
absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. You're right. I would have. I'd have went broke on it with Ben Lamb.
All right. Got to ask you a quick question on this one. Paul will be in the main event this summer. He has won his way into it. Please give him some advice.
Hey.
He is tickled to death, and I've got to compete against him. So, what words of advice? You were there last year for the first time, correct?
Yes.
All right.
For the main event. Yes.
For the main event. This will be his first time. He's an extremely accomplished cash player. He's also played in a large number of tournaments here in the last couple of years. He should go out there and do well, I think. What advice could you give Paul here?
Well, you know, I give Paul the advice that I give the people. It's basically observation and patience. I mean, especially for the World Series, my main event, it was just unbelievable how many people that were in that tournament and that really didn't even know how to play poker because they won their seat from, like, companies and whatnot, sponsorships at the local home game. we're putting these people in, and they had no clue. So I tell people that is one of the best structured tournaments there is. You just can't beat it. And patience and observation, get a feel of your table, you know, maybe throw some aces out there, just see what it takes to get them off of a hand. They might have that second pair out there. What does it take? Are they scared to lose, or are they willing to gamble? You just got to test it, be patient, and observe your table.
That's good advice. I have a particular strategy question for both of you. I was just talking about this with a friend of mine at lunch yesterday who's played the main event a couple of times. And the question has to do with trying to accumulate chips early on. You know, you were just talking about how it's a marathon and you've got to win the war, not each individual battle. But the trend in tournaments over the last year or so has been that the raise sizes have come down. They used to be 3X or 4X, then they were 2.5X. Now, in many cases, people are min-raising or 2.1 or maybe 2.2. And I'm curious about whether in the main event, because you do start with so many chips and the blinds are so small, there's any value in trying to make the pot even bigger when you've got a hand. Not that you are going to raise extra with aces and kings. You want to raise the same no matter what you've got, fours or aces. You got to put the same raise size out there. But I'm curious about whether you think the raise sizes and then the continuation bets need to be larger so that you can build pots, so that you can accumulate chips on that first day.
Well, with me, I like keeping pots small myself. I'd rather, you know, win a small pot and lose a big one. That's the old adage there, and I really believe in that because I've been both routes. I try to control small pots, and let me emphasize that. I try to control it. And you're absolutely right. The betting structures, it seems like has come down to the mid-bet pace. And that's okay. I don't mind that. You know, I try to at least, I usually do around a three. But at the beginning, I just go slow because I'm filling out my table. You're going to be there for a very long time. Don't go over anxious. You're not going to get a whole lot anyway, unless you've got some really aggressive players there at your table. Me personally, I just try to keep small pots, and the most important is I try to control them.
I think that's excellent advice there. I have noticed a trend with some players now, though. They've actually been doing the exact opposite. They've been 5 and 6 betting the size of the big blind, and they're doing that consistently. And the justification they explained to me is, well, number one, a lot of people will fold those pocket fours and fold that ace jack, and you can pick up a lot of pots that way. And if you do happen to have the big hand, you have the chance to really, really build a pot then. Mm-hmm. So if you make a 5X bet out there when you have ace four of hearts, and then you make a 5X bet out there when you have pocket aces, hopefully on the one they'll fold and the other one they'll call you, and away you go. I don't play that way normally. I'd much rather control a pot, especially in something like the main event, because you have so long to play. 2 hour ones. Each level is 2 hours long. It's just amazing how long you got there to play. And then suddenly the blinds go up and it's like, wow, really? That's it? You know? So I play more like Sam.
True. That's true. And the base is on your table too. You know, and it was amazing though at the main event how easy it was for these people to lay down their hands when I raced. And I try not to raise anymore, and I really have to get them off that hand because I don't want to risk my chips. And just like they said, you've got a very long time. And it's amazing how easy it was.
All right. Well, I really appreciate it in here today. I think we're about out of time.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, what are your plans for the WSOP this summer? Since you are playing things like Six Max and horse events at the circuit events, what are you going to do at the Rio this summer?
Well, of course, obviously, I'm going to hit the shootout. So I will be playing most of all the shootouts. I'm going to hit the 1,500, the no-limit ones. And then, of course, now if you've seen the schedule for the Venetian, they've got some really good ones coming up, too. So I might look at those, too.
There are some very good ones. I love playing at the Venetian. Kathy and Tom and the guys over there really do a good job.
Well, Sam, we really appreciate you being on today. I'm glad we were able to finally meet and track you down and get you on the show. We hope you get a lot of points there in New Orleans and get back in the national championship. But either way, we'll see you at the Rio.
Okay, I really appreciate it. Thank you a lot.
All right, take care, Sam.
That is Sam Barnhart, the reigning World Series of Poker Circuit national champion from 2011. And that's all the time we have for today. Dennis, what are you off to?
I'm not even for sure. I had a bit of a long month here, traveling here, there, and everything like that. But I really have three or four different decisions to make now. It's exactly what I'm going to do for the next month.
All right. Well, good luck to you in all of that. I'm going to sit down here and play our regular PLO game here at Harrah's St. Louis. And we'll all meet together again next Tuesday at 3 for another Final Table Poker Radio show. For Dennis Phillips, I'm Paul Harris. This is 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.